Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Bush continues his campaign urging Congress to renew parts of the Patriot Act that are set to expire at the end of the year and to beef up the law to give new powers to the FBI. After touring the new National Counterterrorism Center today, the president highlighted the successes of the Patriot Act.
Can you believe our system didn't allow parts of the FBI to share information, for example? If the intelligence group didn't have a piece of information, they couldn't share it with the enforcement people. The law enforcement people, that didn't make any sense. And so the Patriot Act enabled us to tear down walls.
And the president also deflected criticism that the Patriot Act tramples constitutional rights.
The Patriot Act protects the privacy and civil liberties of every American. That's what the American people got to understand. The Patriot Act conforms to our Constitution. That as we fight this war on terror, we'll honor our Constitution. As we fight the war on terror, we'll protect the civil liberties of our citizens.
Today, a look at a push for the Patriot Act and what else is on the president's plate or perhaps suddenly off it. We'll also look at how the Democrats are faring, thrashing about in the wake of controversial comments by the leader of the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean. Joining us in our political roundtable on the line from Washington, Stuart Rothenberg of the Rothenberg Report. Welcome, Stu.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Linda, welcome back as well.
Hi, thank you.
And let's start with you, Linda. We just heard President Bush call for Congress to renew and expand the Patriot Act. How is the act faring in Congress? Where does it stand? And remind us what the new provisions would do.
Well, I think politically it seems to be doing pretty well. This is one area where the president is very strong. The polls support renewing the act and making permanent the pieces that were due to sunset later in the year. In terms of what the provisions that they want to add some new provisions, those are less popular, but what I'm hearing is that those will likely make it. One of the things that they would like to add is to allow the FBI to subpoena records without the approval of a judge, and they also want to make it easier for the Bureau to get copies of mail.
And you say that this is a popular push for the Patriot Act itself, but you also note that terrorism isn't as high on people's agendas anymore. So why the hard push from the president?
Well, the president has been having a pretty slow go of it for the beginning of the second term. He set off with a very ambitious agenda, and so far he really hasn't accomplished that much on the big ticket items. Social Security isn't going anywhere. His approval on his handling of that issue is only sinking. Iraq isn't going well. And so this is an area where, even though it's sinking, terrorism is sinking as a priority for the American public, it is something that he still does reasonably well on. And so it's probably smart politics for him to be front and center on this issue right now.
And Stu Rothenberg, jump in here, because this new Associated Press poll out today does look as if public support for President Bush's agenda in general is waning. 59% of the country say, 59% of the respondents say the country's on the wrong track.
Yeah, I think Linda has it exactly right in terms of the president's focus and his ability to get certain legislation through Congress. His overall job numbers are down. His job performance in various areas, whether it's the war in Iraq, Social Security, foreign policy, is down. But still in the area of Homeland Security and terrorism, I think the American public and even members of Congress on the Hill are really willing to give the president they're willing to defer to him. They're going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Overall, the administration, I think, has had a very rocky 6 months. If you look at the president's agenda, which was extremely ambitious for a second term, fundamental tax reform, immigration reform, Social Security reform, cutting the deficit in half, conducting the war against terrorism, bringing the war in Iraq to conclusion, or at least taking us down the road toward success there. All of this requires a lot of cooperation from Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill, from the international community, from the invisible hand of the economy, and instead we have higher gas prices and terrorism is up. So I think the White House is really back on its heels, and the Patriot Act is one area where they can point to some success over the years here, and I think the president has some advantages.
Well, and before we move away from the Patriot Act, Linda, just one last thought. You know, opponents to the act and certainly to expanding it are concerned that people's rights are being violated, but it's been hard for them to even point to anything because it's so secret. So how are civil libertarians responding, and what's the thinking about whether this new idea of expanding the Patriot Act will pass?
Well, they're very, very frustrated. They believe there have been a lot of civil liberties violations, but they're stuck in a catch-22 situation where they, because of the secrecy in which searches and inquiries are conducted, there's nothing to grab onto. They don't have any evidence. There was, I think, 7,000 complaints, but none of them have been proven to be a real violation of civil liberties. However, the civil libertarians are arguing that there's no real oversight, that the Justice Department can't police itself, and that there needs to be some independent oversight on this to prove that there are real problems.
Well, you know, one success that President Bush can point to in recent days comes in the area of judicial nominees. The Senate on Thursday confirmed three more appellate court nominees who had long been stymied by the Democratic filibusters. Five of the president's 10 controversial nominees have now been approved. So, Stu, remind us again why Democrats were calling the deal that led to these nominations a victory.
Well, you know, this is one of those cases where both sides have people who are pleased, and both sides have people who are irate about the deal. The Democrats believe that the bipartisan deal was a victory because it preserved the filibuster option down the road. They have not given away, conceded the principle that they have the right to block votes on nominees that they believe are out of the mainstream, extreme, unacceptable. And so the principle continues, and they believe that down the road, other nominees, they may well filibuster, including Supreme Court nominees. Now, you have to understand there are irate conservatives, irate Republicans, who believe that their party gave away the farm. There's a special election coming up in an Ohio congressional race in southern Illinois, outside Cincinnati, where Congressman Rob Portman was appointed U.S. Trade Representative. And a commissioner, a county commissioner, is running. His name is Pat DeWine. That matters because his father is United States Senator Mike DeWine, one of the Republicans who was involved in this negotiated bipartisan agreement on judges. Well, the senator's son is being hammered and is now, I think, likely to lose this congressional special election, in part because conservatives are so irate about the decision. So while the president has gotten a number of judges through, and some Republicans on Capitol Hill believe that over time it'll be difficult for the Democrats to use a filibuster, nobody's really happy about the bipartisan agreement except the people who engaged in it, who can say, see, we avoided the train wreck. We've gotten some judges confirmed, but down the road the Democrats have options. So it really depends on your perspective, who you think won that deal.
That's Stu Rothenberg. His perspective is his, of the Rothenberg Political Report. We're also talking to Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And I want to turn to the Democrats. Let's talk about Howard Dean. And Linda, as you well know, Republicans are saying, yes, please do. The focus has shifted to Howard Dean because of controversial remarks he made about the Republicans. He called them a monolithic party, said they're pretty much a white Christian party, drawing criticism from who?
He's drawn criticism from many Democrats, a lot of Republicans, not all Democrats. Some Democrats run and hide when you try to ask them about Howard Dean, but privately they all make a face. The media, Howard Dean is having fun bashing the media over this, but the fact is he really should know better. And everybody thought that when he was named party chair that he would have his mistakes behind him, his foot and mouth disease. But clearly he hasn't learned his lessons, and bashing the media just isn't going to get him or any Democrats anywhere, because We're going to cover things that he says that are off message or inappropriate, and they're going to enter the media echo chamber. The conservative media will have a field day with it, and he has to just not make comments like that in the first place.
Well, Robin, can I just jump in on mm-hmm. this? And I agree with Linda. But I think the critical point here is, even if you happen to be a liberal Democrat and agree with Howard Dean's assessment of the Republican Party, what you have to understand is the Republicans have plenty of problems of their own right now, and we've talked a little bit about it, and the president's on the defensive, and we have new poll numbers out today from the Associated Press that show bad job approval ratings for the president. Why would you want to distract from that? If you're a Democrat, if you're leader of the Democratic National Committee, why would you want to draw the limelight, the attention to yourself? That is the problem. Even if you believe Dean is right about his characterization of the Republicans, it's simply from a strategic point of view, an inept thing for the DNC chairman to say what he did.
But Stu, you also write that Republicans should remember that elections are never about the chair of one of the National Party committees. In the long run, it's not about him.
Yes, I did write that, and I believe that. And I think that there is a tendency on the part of the Republicans when they see Howard Dean and when they see him. You have to understand the gut reaction they have to Howard Dean, many of these Republicans and conservatives. They just think that he's such a poster child of the left and of opposition to the president that they'll stake their opposition, or they'll stake 2006 to opposing Howard Dean. Look, this is a big story today, and I'd like to hear what Linda says. This is a big story today, but a month from now, 2 months from now, if Howard Dean frankly shuts up, the focus will shift back to the president. And if the Republicans think they can make Howard Dean the story between now and all the way in 2006 or 2008, they'll be barking up the wrong tree. They got to focus on the president's agenda, and they need some accomplishments of their own.
Well, actually, Linda, I want to ask you, is Dean doing what he is supposed to do, which is raising money? There's conflicting reports. You say he's on track. I believe I've read you saying that. Mm-hmm. But then Business Week says Howard Dean's raised voice isn't raising cash.
Well, he is raising money. They say the DNC says that he's raising $1 million a week. He's, through April, raised $18.6 million. He's organizing the party in red states where the party had perhaps as few as two employees. So he is, in some ways, doing what he's supposed to be doing. And he was really doing, I think, a pretty good job of it until his recent gaffes. So I think if Howard Dean can just watch his tongue, this will all go away. He has to just stop the media frenzy and allow the Republicans' problems to rise to the top and really become the focus of attention. The Republicans are super incumbents. They control everything in Washington. And the next election will be all about rating the incumbents, and not hopefully for the Democrats, hopefully not what Howard Dean has to say.
And we have just a few minutes left, a few seconds actually left. And Stu, I just want to go to you. Whatever happened to the Bolton nomination?
Well, it's still out there, and the Democrats are still holding it up and insisting that they won't allow it to proceed unless they get more documents. I think ultimately, Republicans were sure this was a slam dunk once we came back after the break. I think they're still hopeful and still expect it's going to be done. I mean, you have to wonder how long the Democrats can hold this up, but right. It's proving to be an embarrassment, another example of an embarrassment for the president.
Stu Rothenberg of the Rothenberg Political Report. We also spoke with Linda Feldman, Washington correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, our political roundtable on a summer Friday. Thank you both very much.
Sure.
Great, thank you.
And stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Are we finally beating breast cancer? That's the question U.S. News & World Report senior editor Katie Hobson asks in this week's issue. Her answer? Well, Katie now joins us on the line. Katie, welcome.
Thank you.
And you have several answers. Let's begin where you began. You begin your article by setting the scene at a conference in May in which scientists presented a paper on a drug called Herceptin. You write they were greeted like rock stars because of what they had to say. What did they have to say?
What they had to say was that Herceptin, this drug, which had is not a brand new drug. It's been on the market for use in breast cancer patients in advanced stages of disease, but they wanted to test it in women with earlier disease to see if it would prevent the disease from coming back. So they did a large trial, several trials, and what they found was that women who, for whom this drug was appropriate, who took the drug, their risk of recurrence was about half what it was without the drug. Mm. And this is on top of normal chemotherapy, so it's not like you only take this drug.
And so that's quite a boost in the survival rate.
It's a huge boost. And, you know, when you cover cancer for a while, you are used to seeing very kind of incremental progress. But to see such a big reduction, it's hard to overstate how great this was for oncologists. I think they had been expecting something like a 25% reduction, so it was twice that.
And you also write that Herceptin works best for women with tumors classified as making too much protein. They're called HER2, which brings us to another point you make. We say breast cancer, but you write breast cancer isn't even the right name for it. It's really cancer that happens to be located in the breast and many different kinds.
Right. Now that we can look at the actual genetics of these cancers, you can see that what is breast cancer is actually kind of an umbrella term for many different kinds of cancer. And now the goal is to look at all these different types and figure out which are aggressive and which can kind of be treated less aggressively. Because, of course, you don't want to treat every woman with the most aggressive treatment because these treatments have side effects and you can cause a lot of problems if you kind of throw everything you can get at a woman whose tumor wouldn't have grown fast enough to be a problem for her.
Right. Well, in fact, let's talk about some of the other therapies that are proving effective. One targets tumors that are estrogen receptor positive, again, a specific type.
Right. This is this way of classifying tumors has been around for a while. The drug tamoxifen is a big success story because it works in these women whose tumors are affected by estrogen, and tamoxifen changes the way estrogen interacts with those tumors. And there is a new group of drugs that also kind of have similar actions or similar results with slightly different actions, called the aromatase inhibitors. And those, too, are showing to move things along, not as spectacularly as Herceptin, but they are at least a mild improvement over tamoxifen for women with that kind of tumors.
And that's good news because tamoxifen also has some serious side effects.
Yes, and it's also important to know that the newer drugs also have side effects. So a lot is known about the side effects of tamoxifen because it's been around for so long, and these newer drugs, the aromatase inhibitors, have not been around so long. So we know some of their side effects, but we don't quite know over the long term what's going to happen to these women who are on them. But so far, it looks like it's a little better than tamoxifen.
Well, you also write about a recent study published in the journal Lancet that claims that chemotherapy and hormone therapy can protect against a recurrence of the disease more than was first thought.
Right. This study kind of looked back and followed women who had had the chemotherapy and also who had added the hormone therapy, the tamoxifen. And what it found is that those women did a lot better than women who had just had the surgery. And as the years went on, they did even more better, which suggests that for some group of women, they're probably cured. The cancer is not going to come back.
Well, as researchers isolate these different kinds of tumors and target them with therapies, there are still women sitting on the sidelines whose cancer doesn't fit into any category. African American women fall disproportionately into this group. Is there something for them?
Yeah, there are a lot of different kind of subtypes that scientists are working to discover. But one that people are talking about, and I had just heard the term for the first time, are women called who fall into a category kind of called triple negatives. Their cancers do not emit this or overproduce this protein HER2, and they also do not have hormone receptors, so they can't benefit from tamoxifen or from the other newer hormone therapy drugs we were talking about, or the aromatase inhibitors. So these women with triple negative status really are kind of at a loss beyond normal treatment in early stages. And African-American women do seem to fall disproportionately into this category.
Well, you also write about a recent study which showed that a low-fat diet may also prevent a recurrence of breast cancer. And this may be something that, you know, at least everyone can try. Can you tell us a little more about that?
It is. I mean, it's long been thought, and studies have shown to some degree that eating a low-fat diet may help prevent breast cancer. But, of course, there are many, many women who eat right, exercise, you know, don't drink, all the things that you're supposed to do, and they still get breast cancer. This study is a little different in that it looked at whether after diagnosis, if you suddenly changed your diet after being diagnosed with breast cancer and switched to a low-fat diet, whether that would improve the odds that your cancer would not come back. And in fact, they did find that if you adhere to a pretty low-fat diet, your risk of the breast cancer coming back within 5 years was cut by about 20%, which is it's not a huge increase when you kind of look at the raw numbers, but as many physicians have pointed out, there's really no downside to eating a low-fat diet.
Well, Katie Hobson, again, writing about breast cancer in the current U.S. News & World Report, your piece asks, are we beating breast cancer? In your opinion, are we?
Well, you know, you can never say you're beating or you've beaten breast cancer until you can guarantee that every woman who comes into the doctor's office and is diagnosed will be cured. And that is by no means happening, and probably won't happen until we get a complete understanding of, you know, all the different types of breast cancer and how to fight it. But we're definitely making progress as we learn more about the diseases, all the different types of breast cancer, and how to treat each one of them.
U.S. News & World Report senior editor Katie Hobson, her article, Are We Finally Beating Breast Cancer?, appears in this week's issue of U.S. News & World Report. Katie, thank you.
Thank you.
And stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. If consumer spending was an Olympic sport, Americans would win the gold medals without breaking a sweat. Americans spend 99 cents of every dollar made in take-home pay, interest, and dividends. Only a penny is saved. By contrast, the Japanese savings rate is 7.7%. The French tuck away 16%. This frenzy of consumer spending in the U.S. contributes to the growing trade deficit. We're buying about $2 billion a day more from the world than the world is buying from us. Is there a problem here? Here and Now business reporter Mark Mills joins us to put in his saved 2 cents. Mark, why are Americans such poor savers? It wasn't always this way, was it?
No, it wasn't always that way, Robin. We are prodigious consumers these days. We're champions of immediate gratification. It's hard to be a spender and a saver at the same time. It's sort of like a shot putter running the 100-yard dash. He's just not built for that event. And somehow, we're just not wired to be savers in America.
But as I said, it wasn't always that way.
No, it wasn't always in our national DNA. My parents came of age during the Depression, and they were much more conservative about spending and saving. But in post-World War II America, we had a much more expansive view of ourselves and the world. Baby boomers did not inherit the savings gene from their parents. We also have a very innovative economy, and not just in science and technology, but in developing new financial products such as credit cards, no down payment mortgages, and home equity loans where you can free up cash by borrowing against the value of a home. And when it comes to advertising, we're like the rainforest, a dense jungle of messages and temptations reaching out at every turn. I think in the end, it's very simple, Robin. Credit is easy and shopping is fun.
We're also told it's the right thing to do as Americans, you know, to help the economy. But this low savings rate of 1% seems terrible. As you said, 1 cent on a dollar. Is it really as bad as it sounds?
Well, some analysts say the statistics are misleading. For example, capital gains on stocks and the increased value of real estate are not counted as part of the national savings rate. Yet those things can make people feel wealthier. If your house went up in value by $20,000 last year, you may feel that's all the savings you need to do. Also, what Americans pay for education is counted as consumer spending. Some economists say those billions are really an investment in the future, not the same as buying a bottle of wine or a movie ticket. But statistical quibbling aside, the savings shortfall is a problem for the United States.
And where is that problem? What's the risk?
Well, I kind of break it down in two areas. I think it impacts us as individuals in our lives and collectively as a nation. On the personal side, savings help you to build a better life in the future, whether it's to educate your children or set aside money for retirement or to have a cushion against a disaster. Today, students leave college carrying education debt averaging about $20,000. That's partly because of a lack of savings before college. The typical American family has saved just $19,000 for retirement, according to a study just out from Fidelity Investments. That average balance jumps to $60,000 for households headed by people age 55 and up. But that's not much money. I mean, it means a lot of Americans are going to see a big drop in their standard of living if they ever get to retire. The very high bankruptcy rates we're seeing are due in part to people having no cushion in the event of an illness, a job loss, or a divorce. We make ourselves and our families vulnerable by not saving enough, and we jeopardize our future security by living over our heads today.
What about the collective side? You know, how does this low savings rate impact the nation?
Well, deficits represent loans that have to be paid off. It means that future revenues will have to be siphoned off to pay for today's spending rather than applied to the needs at that time. There might be some intergenerational larceny at work in that, to be borrowing against our kids' future. Our overspending today is being financed in large measure, not by our own savings, but by foreign governments and investors. These foreign interests are willing to invest in the U.S. because we seem like a trustworthy creditor. But if the rest of the world, for whatever reason, starts to doubt our credit worthiness, or if we have some other conflict or crisis that causes funds to dry up, we will collectively be in a very vulnerable position. The dollar would plunge if foreigners dump their U.S. holdings. Interest rates would probably spike to attract foreigners, induce them to hang on to their U.S. investments. Higher interest rates could push us into a recession. I mean, this doomsday scenario doesn't have to play out, Robin. It's not inevitable, but it is a risk we run. So it's time for the nation to start living within its means, start saving more, and maybe think more about the future.
Here and Now's business reporter Mark Mills. Sounds as if you won't bump into him at the mall this weekend. Tomorrow at the Belmont Stakes, there will be two Alexes, a Fleet Alex, the horse who dramatically recovered from a stumble to win the Preakness, and outside the track, Alex's Lemonade Stands, some of the 1,000 Alex's Lemonade Stands across the country. They're the legacy of Alexandra Scott, who died last year of cancer at the age of 8, and as her mother Liz told us, began to make lemonade early on in her short life.
My daughter was 4. She had been battling cancer for about 3 years. It was in January of 2000. She insisted for about 6 months, and then finally I asked her one day why she was so insistent on having this lemonade stand, and she said, "I'm not keeping the money. I'm giving it to my hospital."
Yeah, and the story just took off from there, because how could anyone resist such a determined little girl? And the Philadelphia Sixers president went to the stand and he spread the word. And then the owner of a Fleet Alex also heard about this story and wanted to get involved as well.
Yes, the horse was already named Alex after the owner's children. They read about my daughter, Alex, and felt that the inspiration and determination and the strength that she showed was very much how they viewed the horse's attitude and the way the horse had performed.
Boy, and it sure was at the Preakness.
Yeah, exactly. And they felt that there was just this natural connection. So they would donate every time the horse placed first, second, or third. That was in the fall, and they've been doing it ever since.
Wow. Well, and now people listening who want to get involved with this, they can actually have their own lemonade stands.
Right, and there's a simple way of doing it and learning all about Alex's Lemonade Stand, and that's to get the Alex's Lemonade Stand kit. Part of the sale of the kit comes back to the foundation, and it tells you all about Alex, about childhood cancer, and about having an Alex's Lemonade Stand.
Where does the money go?
The money that we've raised has been donated to children's hospitals across the country, from Philadelphia here to Dana-Farber in Boston, all the way out to UCLA Children's.
I am imagining that this kind of a success, you know, this kind of a story just taking off like a horse at a horse race, is about the only way this kind of a loss could be bearable.
I think it is true that it's definitely given us a real focus, and it's kept Alex such a big part of our lives. And we get a lot of comfort out of knowing that out of all of this heartache and tragedy, something so wonderful could happen.
Liz Scott is the mother of the late Alex Scott, the founder of Alex's Lemonade Stand at the ripe age of 4. Alex died at the age of 8. Liz, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
By the way, what's the most somebody's paid you for a glass of lemonade?
I think that when somebody was actually physically at the stand and gave money for a glass of lemonade, it would have to be
$500. $500?
Yep.
Who was that?
Billy King, the president of the Sixers. He does it every year. And he just drinks one cup. He never asks for a free refill.
And I bet you're hoping that when people go to put their money on the horse at the Belmont Stakes, they put their money on the lemonade, too.
Absolutely, yes. That'd be great.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
For more information on the kits and on Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. For thousands of years, explorers have set sail in their quest to discover new worlds. Now, scientists are using a new form of sail to help them explore the mysteries of space. The first ever spacecraft powered by a solar sail is set to launch later this month, testing a technology that could one day power missions into deep space. The Planetary Society of Pasadena, California is a nonprofit group behind the project. Joining us on the line, Dr. Lewis Friedman, who co-founded the organization with the late astronomer Carl Sagan. Welcome, Doctor.
Glad to be here.
And I've got this image in my head from the Terry Gilliam movie, The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen, of this phantasmagoric sailing ship, but up in the air. What will it look like, and how will these sails work?
Well, that's the way I feel some days, that it's complicated kludge that we're running around trying to put together. But the actual image you should have is probably the more romantic one of hoisting a single large sail and going out into the deep ocean. Our craft is a 30-meter diameter sail, so that's nearly 100 feet in size, and it's made up of 8 individual sails, triangular-shaped sails. Once deployed, it reflects sunlight, and the pressure of that sunlight creates a force which we can use to control the direction of flight.
Really, sunlight works like wind?
Well, sunlight is actually a lot stronger than the solar wind. You may have heard of the solar wind. That's made up of electrons and protons, which have mass and travel relatively slowly compared to sunlight, which, of course, travels at the speed of light and is made up of those high-energy photons. We all know that sunlight has energy. We feel it whenever we're standing in the sun. But we can't feel the force of that sunlight until we get out into the vacuum of space, away from all other terrestrial influences and away from the gravity force. Then that force of sunlight from that energy can be used to propel a spacecraft and increase our orbit energy so that we move outward from the Earth and someday outward into the solar system.
Fascinating. And we understand your spacecraft is going to be ferried into space on a Russian rocket originally designed to carry intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now it will be carrying Cosmos 1. And with the sail, we read that in about a day it'll have a speed of about 100 miles an hour, which doesn't sound like a lot. So where does it go from there?
Well, that's the interesting thing. First of all, it's fantastic that we're able to use a Russian ballistic missile actually right out of their operational fleet. But as part of the treaty to reduce those weapons, they're being used for civil applications, and we're glad to be one. And then we take it up into orbit, because, of course, you have to get off the Earth, and rockets are necessary for that. Once we're in orbit, we have what is the standard orbital velocity at that altitude. And it doesn't matter whether you have a sail or whether you don't have a sail. You have the same velocity at that point. The sail is a very low acceleration device. It only increases the speed at a fraction of a mile an hour in a few minutes. And then as it starts to increase that speed, then, of course, it's acting all the time. And that's where you pick up the big velocity change. Because if the sail would operate for days and weeks and months and then ultimately years, then you can move out into the solar system very fast, and you could even reach Pluto in just a couple of years with future solar sails. The first time, we're willing to go very slow. We're willing to just have a measurable increase in altitude, even a few kilometers. And for people not satisfied with that, I remind them of the Wright brothers, who flew 12 seconds and went nowhere. But it was a rather significant development in flight, and we just need to fly a short amount of time and show the feasibility of being able to control flight.
What are the other advantages of a solar sail power over, you know, conventional fuel?
Well, the main advantage is it doesn't require any fuel, and that way it can go into the solar system and carry large payloads without having to carry the fuel along to propel it. What it's really nice for is to rendezvous with other space objects like comets and asteroids, to make round trips to Mars, Venus, Mercury. The real hope, of course, is to use it someday for interstellar travel, because it's the only technology we know of that can lead to interstellar travel.
Well, the Planetary Society is setting up observation posts around the world. Will we be able to see it, and what would we look for?
It will be seen by many, many people. It'll be as bright as the brightest star in the sky. We'll have at our website all the information necessary for observing the solar sail.
Dr. Lewis Friedman, Executive Director of the Planetary Society, launching the first-ever solar sail-powered spacecraft. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Lou, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with an update of a story we reported earlier this week, which has gotten murkier. Tommy Hook is a whistleblower at the Los Alamos National Laboratories in New Mexico. He's due to testify before Congress this month about what he says is waste and overbilling at the nuclear research facility. Hook was brutally beaten outside a topless bar in Santa Fe last weekend, and he believes he was attacked in an effort to silence him. Well, the Santa Fe Police Department is now saying it believes Hook was beaten up after he struck a pedestrian in the parking lot of the bar, and that he may face charges in the incident. Hook himself is standing by his account, saying it all comes down to who is telling the truth, and we will continue to follow this story. When you think about dance, you probably think of the spectacular leaps of Baryshnikov or the hyper-flexible bodies of ballerinas. Well, a new dance ensemble for seniors is redefining greatness in dance. They're called the Prometheus Dance Elders Ensemble of Cambridge, Massachusetts, a group of 10 women ages 60 to 82. A few of them have danced professionally, but most simply wanted to be dancers when they were children and had to give it up for one reason or another. And in their first performances this year, Prometheus Dance Elders Ensemble astonished their senior center audiences.
And there's a dance in the old dame yet.
Excellent.
Very good.
It was so fresh and uncontrived. The movements were lovely. Very simple and yet beautiful as an ensemble.
There's a Dance in the Old Dame Yet is the title of the new group's new dance, and in it, dancers tell their stories. They do high kicks while sitting in lawn chairs. And they show everyone just what overcoming obstacles is all about. Here in us, Lynn Menegon spoke with two of the dancers and choreographer Tommy Neblett.
They're incredible. It is. It's an incredible sight to see. Because, number one, you usually don't do high kicks sitting in a lawn chair, like you mentioned. And especially if you're 70 years old, you don't do that. But, you know, it's showbiz. And some of the considerations we had to think about was, obviously, physical ability. How fast could they move? Could they turn? Could they get down and up and down off the floor quickly or easily? So it was a learning process. What can they physically do and what can they cannot do?
When I was a little girl, I passionately wanted to be a dancer. But I got sidetracked and became a university professor.
Betty Millhandler is going to be 82 this summer. She studied dance with some of the greats, like Martha Graham and Alvin Ailey. But she only began performing after she retired from teaching social work. And about 2.5 years ago, she had a stroke in an elders dance class.
I had just finished class, and they thought I was leaning over to tie my shoe. And I don't remember anything from there on, but obviously I toppled over, and it was very dramatic, I understand. But as I say, I have no memory of it, and I didn't have any memory for, well, I don't know how many days, actually.
And here you are.
And here I am.
Still kicking.
Yeah.
There is a photograph on a promotional postcard that the group has sent around. And there are three women in the lawn chairs in the high kick, legs up, And Betty, you are one of them. You're first in line there, and you have just such an astonishing presence.
Thank you.
Have people commented to you about this photograph? We'll put it online so people can see it.
Well, as I've given it out to people and all that, the first response I get is, wow. People, and they'll say they're very impressed, and I said, I am too. It's still alive and kicking.
One of the things that makes this piece very interesting, remarkable, is each one of the dancers at some point in the production stands up and speaks, starting with the sentence, when I was a little girl. Betty, can you tell me what was your
statement? I said, when I was a little girl, I passionately wanted to be a dancer. But I got waylaid and became professor emerita at Boston University. But, as I said, I always studied dance.
Did dance help you through this?
That's what everybody tells me, that if I had not been a dancer, I would not have come back quite to the extent that I did.
They called me a little teacher.
Dancing alongside Betty is Dorothy Elizabeth Tucker, soon to be 83. She's the oldest in the group and a former child educator. And although she didn't dance professionally, she started a creative movement program for special needs children.
One of the ways to feel good about oneself is to appreciate one's movement. The heart beats, you breathe, everything has motion and everything is changing. And to allow someone else to tell you that your movement isn't precious, I think, is not very good. It's an unhappy kind of thing.
When I was a little girl,
I wanted to be a teacher. In my living room, there was a picture of my uncle and my godmother in their caps and gowns. And in my large kitchen, there was a desk and a blackboard, and I taught every adult that ever came into my home. They called me the little teacher, and I've been teaching ever since. And that is really true.
I believe it.
And what I have discovered about teachers, it's the thrill of somebody learning something, the uh-huh in life, so that no matter where the person is developmentally, when they get that uh-huh and you're there with them to experience, it's just such a marvelous feeling. And I think that's true of dance too. When somebody really gets it and the teacher's there, there's a celebration.
And what about the audience, when the audience gets it?
Well, I never thought too much about performance until really lately, and I'm getting so I like it. And what it is, it's a form of communication. We interact with each other. It's a feeling, although because I can't usually see the audience. I mean, it's not like when you're telling a story or something and you have eye-to-eye contact, you know, that kind of thing. But it's more inner feeling. You know when the group is with you, the audience is with you, or would like to be with you. I always say when I get down on the floor, I have all the elders looking, wondering if I'm ever going to get up. And when I do, I can feel them rising with me in their feelings.
Dorothy Elizabeth, Betty, and other members of Prometheus Dance Elders Ensemble will continue their performing in the fall. Our piece was produced by Lynn Menegon. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again. Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.